No, this is perfect. Perfect. Yeah. So I'm just gonna give you a quick introduction to what it is. Initially, Mono is an open source implementation of the .NET framework. It includes three major components today: a set of development tools that includes compilers, assemblers, linkers, all those things. A runtime engine. This is a facility that provides a number of services. We'll talk about that later. And a set of compatible class libraries to .NET. This is based on all of the work in Mono is based on the standards that Microsoft submitted to the ECMA organization and to the ISO standards body. One of the interesting things that Microsoft did is that anything that Microsoft submitted to ECMA all of the patents that Microsoft might have on any work that they submitted to ECMA, they have granted a patent for anyone to use. So that is really interesting, and we'll get to the tricky points of patents later. So that's in general the idea of what we wanted to do with the Mono project. It's a .NET implementation. We have a number of things. It's based on the .NET framework and the ECMA standards. Now, the reason why we wanted to do this is that by the end of 2000, at Xemium, we had developed Evolution. It's a very large application. Many developers were involved in its development. It is a relatively expensive piece of software for us to produce. And we spent a lot of the time while developing Evolution in dealing with memory-related problems. Small applications are probably fine to develop small applications in C. You don't suffer too much pain with small applications. But Evolution is a multi-threaded, multi-component, very, very large, multi-programmer piece of software. And the problem that you have with this beast is that it's very hard to track errors. There were a number of problems in Evolution 1.0. Before the Evolution 1.0 came out, that we had to track down with special tools like Purify, basically memory that was a lot that was released twice, memory that wasn't properly released, buffers that were overflown, all sorts of those C-related problems. And to make things worse, Evolution is also a multi-threaded application. So debugging this sort of problems with multi-threaded applications with a C runtime that is not always thread safe and has all kinds of little gotchas in different systems was a pain. So around that time, Microsoft came out with the specifications for .NET, and we saw that it was a nice thing, and we were interested in using all of this technology to build better applications. So basically, the idea is instead of devoting 17 of our best programmers to work on Evolution for 3 years, couldn't we build two applications for the same time, or couldn't we make a much better Evolution at the same time? So that seems like a good idea. Also, something which is interesting is that .NET ships with a language, a programming systems language called C Sharp, which is pretty good for developing system applications. I'll get to that later. In fact, just something I want to mention here is C Sharp is not necessarily the best programming language for every task, but it's a pretty good programming language for the particular task of writing system applications like Evolution. So if you're building scripts or if you're building web pages or things like that, C# is probably not for you. But it's probably useful if you're building these large applications that you're planning on developing over the course of the years. So some of the development tools we have produced, there's more, but this is just a summary. Today we have a C# compiler. It's completely written in C# itself. It's about 50,000 lines of code of C#. And one of the interesting things is that the compiler can bootstrap itself on a 1 GHz computer in 6.5 seconds. So this looks like a very fast compiler but in reality it's a slow compiler compared to GCC. One of the interesting things that happens is that GCC, when you compile C code or C++ code, you have to include millions and millions, well, I don't know how many lines, but you tend to include hundreds and thousands of header files. And that makes GCC, on average, much slower than the Mono C# compiler. So although in reality, the Mono C# compiler, it's a slower compiler, It also has to parse a lot less information than a traditional C or C++ compiler has to do. Effectively, when you create a library in the .NET universe, all of the information about API entry points, classes, fields, methods, all of this information is preserved. So it's very much like in the days of Turbo Pascal, right? So all of the information that you have for a module is maintained. So it effectively amounts to a precompiled library. All of your information is already precompiled, so you just extract information from this precompiled thing. So that's what makes the C# compiler faster than your average C compiler. Bootstrapping the whole mono takes about 5 minutes, and it's much larger than an evolution today. So that gives you an idea. About 1 million lines of code of C# gets compiled in about 2 minutes. We also have an IL assembler. It's almost complete. The 10% that it's missing, we pass all of the regression test suites from Microsoft. The 10% missing is the new extensions that were added for doing generic types. The VB.NET compiler, we estimate that it's at 50%. It's hard to tell exactly where we are because there's no public regression test suite for the language or a good reference rate. And JavaScript, we just started work on this thing, so it's very, very early stages. Yesterday there was a talk from Martin that discussed the Mono debugger. The Mono debugger is interesting because we decided not to use GDB for a number of problems that Martin discussed yesterday, but it's a debugger that can debug both Mono applications and non-Mono applications. And unlike GDB, it's not a single, I mean, it has the backend, which is a set of classes that control the debugging process, and it has a bunch of frontends. Today we have three frontends. One is a command line interface. Another one is a scripting engine, which we use to do regression tests on the debugger itself. So we do things like running a test suite that makes sure that we can insert breakpoints, examine variables, change the variables, properties, and so on. And finally, a GUI edition of these debuggers, so you can do your traditional debugging with a GUI application. If you don't like that, if you don't like GTK, which is what we use for a debugger, you can use Qt. And finally, our documentation system that I'll show you soon. Since this is a development platform for the most part, and we don't want to point you all the time to the Microsoft site, we wanted to have a very good documentation system, and that's a big part of the effort that we're doing. I'll show you some of the things we've been doing there. Now, about the C#, as I said, just a couple of features so you get an idea. It has a very similar feel to Java. I would say that it's basically what they did is very simple. They took Java and they took all of the comments that people made to Sun about what things they wanted to see in Java that Sun ignored, and they put them in. It's a very easy recipe for creating a better Java. They will never admit that it's based on Java, though. They keep saying that it's based on C++, but that's not the case. It's a strong type system. Although it's a strong type system, it has kind of a backdoor. Everything in C# is an object. Numbers are objects, or you can treat them as objects. So, for example, in Java, you have this difference between an integer and a system in 32. I don't know what the exact name is, but. But in C#, you can treat them just equally, just as the same object. You can put any integer, any number into a hash table without wrapping it first. It's an object-oriented language with single inheritance, multiple interfaces. This exposes kind of the virtual machine environment that C# runs on. And as I said previously, it's good for application development, but not for scripting applications. If you want to do scripting, I suggest you use a different programming language. Another thing which is interesting from .NET and C# is that what they have this thing called attributes. And last year, for those who didn't see it, last year I showed can you guys see that? Yeah. So for example, you can do things like this. An attribute basically is an annotation on the code. So I can do things like flags, and you can say carry flag equals 1, overflow equal 2, interrupt. This will be, for example, the flag for a CPU, right? And if I have a variable of this type, now this in C will typically, the value of this thing in C would be 3, right? Right? So, let me do this. Whoops. So for example, right, make sense? Yeah? So one of the interesting things about C-sharp is that I can annotate things. So in this case, I can use a very interesting attribute. I'm going to annotate these enumerations with the flags attribute. And what this is telling the runtime engine is that it should interpret this enumeration not as a number, but as a flag. And this means that it's going to treat it as a bit field, right? So routines that print information, routines that modify the information will use this attribute to render the information properly. Whoa, what happened there? Oh, it's number. Oh, that's what happens when you use the wrong name. So I'm just going to do this little trick. I'm missing a bracket? You mean that guy? That was embarrassing for a second. I was doing a demo last week in Argentina. Well, we'll tell you later. So anyway, as you can see, instead of printing here, I don't know if you can see, but instead of printing 3, now the runtime knows that it has to print it as a flag, right? And there's a bunch of other things like that. I'll show you today at the GTK Sharp Talk one of the things we use to make developing with Gnome easier. Using this trick. And it's used all over the place. For example, versioning is stored in this information. Assembly signing is stored using this information. Things like web services, the way you describe a web service is by adding a flag saying this is a web method, right? And you say this can be invoked remotely or this cannot be invoked remotely, or you can configure. For example, there's another very interesting sample is, let me show you this one. Oops. Oh, actually, it's pretty good. Okay, so this is something from my demonstration last week in Argentina. But I have this, .NET has this very interesting feature called the XML serializer, which is a mechanism for binding XML data to data structures, right? So typically you would do your process of, with an XML library, you would say things like, for saving data, you would say, well, begin an attribute, begin an element, begin an attribute, write this element, write this other child, and you would do things that way. Or during parsing, you would have to say, well, expect the following element, then expect the following attribute, then expect this thing, and that's the way you do the parsing. With the serializer, on the other hand, what you do is you basically map a class to an XML, schema. In this case, the scheme is very simple. But what I'm saying is I have this class data that contains 3 fields, and these are all Spanish names. I probably should rename them. But I have nombre, which means name, edad, which means age, edad real, which means real age. And I have an array of strings called friends, right? And I'm passing this. I'm going to comment this out for now. So you get the idea. But basically what I'm going to do here is I create a serializer for this data structure, right? And I fill in the data. So now I have a traditional C-sharp structure, traditional structure that I fill in with data. And now I'm going to serialize it, and I'm going to serialize this to XML on the console, right? So what is the name of this file? It's A, okay. My favorite file name. So now notice that we didn't write any XML here. The .NET framework takes care of doing all of the XML serialization for us. It basically mapped or internal C-sharp data structure into XML. Now, notice that it's using amigos as a field there, and it's using string for each one of these individual names, right? This is the data that I filled in C-sharp. And I can remove this thing. For example, here there's an attribute, again, this thing in brackets. And this attribute is instructing the runtime, right? It's informing it that for the items of this array, it should use the name persona, which means person, right? So instead of having string, quantum mass, string, it's going to say person, quantum mass, person. And again, this is an interesting feature. Wait, let me compile it again. And this is used all over the .NET framework. Now you can see the difference between this guy, right, and this other guy. Do we have water somewhere? Oh. So this trick with attributes is used all over the place in the .NET framework, not only with web methods and serialization. And as I said, we make use of that thing on the for doing GUI applications. Anyways, also as part of our work with C#, we're now working with the ECMA team. There's a number of new changes coming into the language. We already have some of those implemented. We're just missing the biggest one. They're releasing a preview of C# 2.0 this October at the PDC, and we already have some of the beginning of it. I mean, we have already iterators, which is it's a feature found in Python and finding the icon programming language as well. And I think someone else also got it recently. We got lambda functions, so now you can create at any point, you can return functions as objects, as their value return values, and generate types. This is similar to C++'s templates. So, but basically it's a mechanism for instantiating types based on type parameters. That's all it is. It's not as complete as the C++ mechanism. Now the main difference between this, between the generic support in C# and in Java, and the C# support for generic types in C# and C++ is that in the C# universe, what they did is they extended the virtual machine to know about generic types. So that means that the virtual machine can actually generate code optimized for the particular data type, very much like C++, right? So the difference with Java is C# and the virtual machine can generate code which is optimized for your particular data type, right? That's what C++ and C# do. But on the other hand, just like Java, you preserve the semantic information of the generic type. So unlike C++, you don't need to actually reparse the information. You don't need to have the source code available for the template. Again, it's all precompiled in the same way that we precompile the code for other libraries. We also precompile the code for generic types. And again, it's a big improvement for compilation times. And this, we only have a prototype. We haven't finished generic types, but the rest we have. Lambda is on my hard drive. It's not checked in yet in CVS. So that's the language. Now, the language basically generates code. C# generates code for this virtual machine called the common intermediate. The common language infrastructure virtual machine. And this virtual machine, Microsoft people call it the virtual execution system. The virtual execution system provides three main services. There's other services, but there's three main services. The first one is it provides compilation facilities. It compiles code in this intermediate language into native code. And it can do this just in time, right? So it basically compiles code on the flight as it goes, or it can do it ahead of time. So instead of having very big startup times in many applications, you can pre-compile all of your code and use that pre-compiled code as part of your execution. So it's ahead of time compilation is just a mechanism for reducing startup time. We also provide garbage collection for any CIL code, and we provide thread management and thread pool management for CIL code. And what is interesting about this system is that we're talking about CIL code, we're not talking about C#. So that means that any programming language that generates CIL code gets these benefits. So for example, we have a C#, the Mono team produces a C# compiler, a VB.NET compiler, or IL assembler, if you like to program in assembler. What else do we provide? A Logo compiler, if you like Logo. And JavaScript is just beginning. But you can also use third-party compilers from other people. There's an FL compiler from IC Systems. There's a Smalltalk compiler, commercial Smalltalk compiler, COBOL compiler, Ada compiler, Oberon compiler, and all of those compilers basically generate code that we can host. And the interesting thing is that all of these languages can live together, and we offer the same set of services to all of these programming languages, no matter where they come from. Oh, it's a perfect little drawing. So basically, all of these programming languages, all of these are their commercial implementations for those languages. They generate code for the common intermediate language, and then we use either a just-in-time compiler or ahead-of-time compiler to generate code for the target architecture. I'm going to show you a little sample of what this looks like. I always use the same name. Oh, crap. Okay. So, for example, a little program that that adds two numbers. Let's add. What will be good? The two arguments passed in the command line. And this has no error recovery. Okay. Does that work? Oops. I typically don't use VI. I don't know why I have developed this problem with. I usually use Emacs, and I don't know why my brain has been locked down into, when I'm editing small files, I always launch VI. I tried aliasing. Did I tell you that story? I tried aliasing VI to VI equals to user bin Emacs, and I ended up typing user bin VI. It's a little brain problem I got there. Oh, there's a problem. Oh, okay. So we're going to add 1 and 2, and that prints 3, right? Now I'm going to show you the disassembly for that code. So that little program that you just saw, ooh, mono this. Okay, this is the disassembly code for that little program that we wrote in C sharp. This is a code. And it's very simple. The first instruction, what does it do? What does that do? Oh my god, what does that do? Well, I have no idea what that does. Loads a zero. Well, it doesn't matter. Oh no, actually, I do know what it does. Hold on. I just don't understand the first instruction. Load argument 0. What would that be? Oh, of course. Okay. So the first argument is the array of strings, right? So it loads up, then it says, I want to load the first value, args of 0. It loads the element, right? Load element through reference, calls the parse routine, the system in32 parse. Stores the result in the first variable, local variable, which is the one called v0. Does the same with the second argument, stores it in v1, then loads the first local variable, the second local variable, adds them, and calls the method. Now, notice something about this. This disassembly code contains a great deal of symbolic information. It contains the names. Notice it contains the namespaces, the libraries it's calling, the methods. It even contains the types of the parameters that are invoked, right? The method in here contains all sorts of interesting information, like it's a private method, it's a static method as opposed to an instance method, it's a default method to be invoked, it's CIL code, it's managed code, right? It contains all of these useful annotations, right? This is information that is available at runtime. Now, when you execute this code, the MonoJIT compiler basically can execute this code, and I'll show you the generated output, because it's not as pretty. C.exit. And that's a JIT compiler JITing. It does its JIT thing. It actually has to JIT a lot of startup code. Oh my god, I didn't know it was so much. Okay, so that's it. Oh, I have to pass two arguments, 1 and 2. So you just saw the JITing of throwing an exception. There it goes, very nice, very nice. Now, something which is interesting is we developed a first generation JIT engine, which was pretty good. I mean, for a bunch of people who have never built compilers and assemblers before, it was a pretty good JIT engine, considering, as I said, that we were GUI people and we're doing Gnumeric and Evolution and all those sort of things before. So for a bunch of guys who did GUI work, it was a good JIT engine. And we're actually 3 times faster than Nencafe, a Java JIT VM for Linux. I mean, It's probably one of the worst jitters. Anyways, doesn't matter. It's unfair to compare to them. But basically, this is a generated code. Let me see, where's the main? Oh my god, I'm never gonna see it. So this is all the destructor code that we get to see. Oh, here it is, right line. Oh my god, we're never gonna see the build code. And buffer, slash, light lane, set light lane. Oh god, there's a lot. Well, you're not gonna see it. Well, we can do this, we can send it to a file so you can see it. Or we do the nice computation. Maybe I should use a different name for this, but name. Oh, here it is. So this is the JDF code. Looks pretty nice. Where's the addition? There must be an addition somewhere here. Oh, here's the addition. Oh no, this is not the addition. I don't know where the addition is. Where is it? So this is the first call to int parse. Wow, I don't know where this code jitted the stuff by. Well, it doesn't matter. You guys will have to take my word for that. But so basically, what we do here is we never execute. We never really execute this common intermediate language. What we do is we jit the code, right? As I said previously, we now also have an ahead of time compiler. Oh, we should do that. We should show that. So instead of having to wait, I mean, this was a big problem for Java people because Swing is a very big set of class libraries, and every time you run a Swing application, you have to jit all of this chunk of code. So one thing that early on we wanted to do was to provide a functionality to pre-compile all of this code before you executed it, so you didn't have to do the jitting at startup time. So to do that with Mono, it's relatively simple. Let's see, we have c.exe. So what I do is I just say Mono, ahead of time compile, c.exe. That it compiled it. And now we're gonna list all of the files. And as you can see, here it is. Here's the original executable file, and now we have generated the native assembly file. Now, one downside with the current mechanism we use for pre-compiling is that you need to keep the original file around, the c.exe, because we keep all the rich metadata information in the original file. So the only thing we're doing is, the only trick we're playing here is the pre-compiled version lives in the .so file, but things like attributes, things like method names, all the semantic information is still in the original file. So you still need to deploy the two files together. So you're not getting rid of the original file today. We could picture a moment where that would be supported, but not today. And basically what the runtime does is if it finds a file that ends in .so in the same place where your executable lives, it picks that as the precompiled code. And there's a signature there to verify that it's is the one that actually belongs to that. I should probably just do it like this. So today we have a JIT engine for the x86, and we almost have a finished version for the PowerPC. It's not finished, and I'll explain why in a second. So a few little things before we move on. Our C# compiler is written in C#, just like our VB compiler or JavaScript compiler. It's a really fun language to program in. We've got our second generation compilation engine, and I'll talk about that later, about other features that we added there. Today we have finished components. We have the kernel component finished, the XML component finished. That includes XPath, XSLT, XPath Navigator. As of 2 weeks ago, XML serialization is completed, so we can do this mapping of structures to XML both ways. And there's actually very nice tools that, given an XML file, will guess the schema. So, and this is sort of interesting because in the early days, when we didn't understand the whole view of XML in .NET, we would do the regular GNOME thing, which is, as regular C programmers, we would just use the low-level API and parse the XML ourselves. Right? Then we discovered this thing called XPath, which apparently everybody knew about except us. That means Duncan and myself. And with XPath, you can actually extract information from an XML file much more efficiently than you can with the regular traversing of the trees. And for a while, we were just writing code using XPath. Which you all, XPath is the best invention since sliced bread. And then we discovered XML serialization. XML serialization is just completely cheating. We had this mechanism before to load XML documentation. All the XML documentation is in XML form. And we had all these XPath expressions to extract pieces of the documentation piece by piece by piece by piece. And it turns out that you can, instead of doing all of that, you can just use the schema that was provided with the documentation and generate the equivalent C# class. And then you just load the thing and it's in a structure. The data is already structured for you. You don't have to do anything. So that was a revolution in the XML thing. And it's just something that I wanted to share with you because I've always been reluctant to understand XML, and I figured I just need to know how to find the next element, and then I'll recursively parse the file, which is what we typically do. At least that's what I typically did. XPath was the next level. XML serialization is, now I understand why everybody's so excited about XML serialization, because it's so easy to use. It just maps to your data structures. Today we also have implemented the web forms component of ASP.NET. That's the technology for building websites. It's not targeted for quick little hacks. It's more targeted for building medium applications. It's not targeted for the large enterprise applications. It's not a J2E replacement. Let's say the J2E is at the top, ASP.NET is in the middle, and PHP is at the bottom. Well, PHP can move and J2E can move, but basically that you can think of it that way. J2E, very complex, very academic. ASP.NET, simpler than that. PHP, much simpler. So the higher you move into the hierarchy, the more control, the more formality you have. The lower you move, the more flexibility you have, and the less framework you have, and the more of build it yourself you get. We don't have the web services implemented yet, but we're working on that. As of today, we have web services clients working. And if I get the network up, I'll show you the Google API. But basically, you can download the Google API from Google, and it works out of the box. Even the GUI applications work. We also have ADO.NET supported. Not only the traditional ADO.NET, but we also support all of the extra database providers that Microsoft doesn't provide. So we have MySQL provider, Postgres provider, Sybase, DB2, SQL embedded, I mean, SQL shot, what is it called? SQLite? No. SQLite. Well, a bunch of other. We have a bunch of data providers that Microsoft doesn't have. Oracle, but now they do. And we also have pieces which are not part of the standard .NET specification. We have Mozilla Sharp, bindings for Mozilla, and it was very embarrassing last week doing a demo where it didn't work. And that it was not my fault, it was all Glade's fault. GTK Sharp, Warby Sharp for doing OGA encoding and decoding, OpenGL Sharp, Apache integration with ASP.NET, so if you want to run your server, your ASP.NET application with Apache, we have that. And we work with other teams. We work with the Sharp develop team to implement Sharp ZipLib. We provide a bunch of fixes to them. And the Sharp WT, which is this new toolkit. This new toolkit that these guys have been porting over from Eclipse. Basically, Eclipse uses this new toolkit called SWT, which uses the native look and feel of each platform. In Windows, it uses Windows widgets. In Linux, it uses GTK2. So the guys are porting the Sharp developed GUI development tools from Windows Forms to Sharp WT, and it's working in some way in Mono. It's not, the GTK2 port is not finished, but other than that, there's no problems. Just so you get an idea for when I know the patent question is going to come up, so just so you are prepared. And this looks a lot better in my screen than it does up there. Yeah, the colors didn't really map well. But the pieces on that nasty, I don't even know how to call it. I should have picked a different color. Okay, so these guys, hold on. These guys. The guys in, oh crap, it doesn't change the color. What the hell? Okay, you see those three guys? Oh, there's another color bar? This one? Oh, no? Gradient? Okay. So the pieces with the beautiful gradient which are the core classes, the XML binding and the runtime engine, and I should say C# and JavaScript, but last night when I was redoing my slides I didn't think of that. Those are covered by the ECMA specification. All of that is given by ECMA, no patents, and that's where most of the smarts are. Then everything in blue has never been standardized. I like to think that it's not been standardized because it's not as mature or as pretty as the rest. That's what I tell myself at night. And we're in Europe, so it doesn't matter because there's no software patents here, so it doesn't matter. But in the US, I always get the question. And the pieces in that, in the other yellow, I mean, these guys over here, So I should use this guy. And those guys, okay, now you can see. And those guards are pieces that are not available, that are not part of the .NET specification. They're more things that were developed either for Mono or together with Mono. And we have a lot of stuff, like XMRPC wasn't done for Mono, but there are pieces that we ship with Mono. So things like ReactNG, the Mono POSIX, and the PEAPI, things for manipulating images, .NET images, SharpZipLib, OpenGL, OGG, all that crap. And we ship it with Mono. So just keep that in mind. When the patent question comes, it only applies to the pieces in purple. And today we have implementations of. Okay, let me show you what we have implementations for. We have implementations for this guy, and what happened then? Okay. So the pieces that the only three remaining things in purple are the things that we're missing. They're there in some kind of support or shape, but they're not finished. Now, since Mono is a development framework, it's very important to have good development, good documentation. So we've got the debugger, we've got the tools, and now we have to get the documentation. Things which are of interest is the monkey guide. The monkey guide is an effort that was begun by, it began with Martin, and now Johannes has taken over the work. Is Martin here? Oh, there you are. Oh, there he is. And he began with this thing called the GNOME.NET tutorial. Was it called GNOME.NET initially? Yeah, GNOME.NET. So he did a tutorial of how to develop GNOME applications using Mono and .NET. And eventually it evolved into a full tutorial. So now they're doing C# tutorial, they're doing installation instructions, facts, all sorts of things. And it's probably one of the most important pieces of the project because without this piece of, I mean, this is a development platform. Without documentation, it's completely useless. And although we can reuse a lot of what Microsoft produces, and that's probably one of the beauty of, one of the nicest things about Mono, it's not only about software reuse, it's also about reusing Microsoft's money. So Microsoft spends money on marketing, on books, on paying people to go and promote it, on tutorials, bribing universities, all of those fun things. And we get to reuse all of their money they put into teaching people C#. Most of that knowledge, 90% of the knowledge you get in .NET or C#, applies directly to Mono. But there are some specific things about installation of Mono, GTK#, things that need to be documented, which are not part of a traditional .NET book. So the Monkey Guide has been available for a long time on the Mono site. It's www.gomono.com/tutorial. But we also ship it now as part of the MonoDoc effort, and I'll show it to you in a second. Then the second chunk of work is documenting our APIs. A lot of the documentation for everything that ECMA covered, and that's roughly about 800 classes, or 500 classes, I forget, was documented already by the ECMA people. So it comes in a nice XML form. So what we did is we just did what I described before with XPath and all those mistakes. And now we ship that documentation. We have extended it to cover the non-ECMA pieces, so we have documentation for that too. and it's a work in progress because ECMA provided full docs and we need to fill in the others ourselves. And we have a massive undertaking to document GTK Sharp. In fact, we think that the GTK documentation is actually, it's good if you're a programmer and you're willing to read the source and read lots of samples, but it's not a very good documentation system. It's not very good documentation, the GTK one. So we're taking the GTK documentation, adding samples for every API call. We're trying to make the text a lot more comprehensive. We're grabbing pieces from the Xlib reference manual where we can, right? Because, for example, all of the GTK documentation sets the stipple pattern or changes the GC values, right? So what is a GC? So we went there and we took and copy-pasted all the text from the original Xlib manual so we have much better documentation. And I think we're doing a great job. We still need to document a lot of GTK Sharp. We could say that probably 30% of GTK Sharp has been documented so far, but the documentation that we have in some areas is very, very good and much better than the original GTK one. Also, a very strange phenomenon happened, which is there's a unique group of Spanish hackers, and you probably saw them last night. It was a crowd of 32 drunk people at the bars at 4 a.m. in the morning, and they're obviously not here. But it's very surprising because there's a very large GNOME developer community, and there's also a very large mono Spanish developer community. I don't know why that happened. But for example, at some point, the Spanish hackers were turning on a bunch of tutorials in Spanish that we don't have yet in English. Typically with open source, the tutorials have been produced first in English and then been translated. In this particular case, in the case of Mono Hispano, which is the name of their site, they have been coming up with tutorials for pieces and components of Mono before there's an English translation. So now we've got the inverse problem. We need volunteers to translate from Spanish to English, right? And finally, eventually we had to integrate all of this information together and we produced this thing called Monodoc. I'll show you Monodoc. Currently, Monodoc GTK HTML, the same widget that Mono uses. So here we have the Mono handbook, which is the monkey guide, right? And you can read the monkey guide online, so you can get an idea what is .NET, so you get some description there, what is Mono, right? How do you install this beast? A little problem with the XML, obviously. Right, a bunch of little things. Images are not working, as you can see. Very nice. The GNOME.NET tutorial, right here, GNOME.NET. Very nice little samples. We'll get the images working soon. But the point is that we've been trying to make the tutorial very easy to use. And we're trying to make it comprehensive. Typically, you would see people using DocBook. We're not using DocBook. We're using plain HTML with CSS. We figured DocBook is too hard to maintain. Nobody understands it. Nobody can make changes. Nobody can get a decent DocBook installation across all systems. So we figured, why not just use HTML and CSS? And now you can flame me for that. But this is very easy. If you want to produce documentation, it's very easy to produce documentation. And in a few months, if you insist on using DocBook, you're free to contribute the DocBookization of it. But I think that DocBook is a colossal failure. That's my opinion. Class libraries, this is the class libraries. Now, one thing that Monodoc does is that it has multiple providers. So actually, we have this HTML provider, that is what you just saw, which integrates the tutorial information. This one is using the ECMA provider. The ECMA provider actually has some smarts about doing type lookups, member lookups. It can do things like rendering all of the types in the namespace, right? So it's a lot smarter than this. It's a smart help provider. So actually, some of the content here is dynamically generated. And it also looks up, it can also look up the existing assemblies on the disk, and it can tell you, we have docs, but we don't have implementation yet. So you'll get a flag, for example, this one. So for example, this one, it says, app domain unload exception. Well, first, we don't have documentation, but we also know that there's a flag in the code. We use an attribute in Mono that says, this method we have missing methods here, we have missing functionalities in this class. So for example, if you click on these guys, it will take you to the implementation of, it will take you to the description of the class. You can get a, this is the description, well, you don't see the scroll bar, but give you a full description of thread safety, remarks, some events, thread exceptions that it might throw, all of the members for this. Oh, Jesus, I can't see the scroll bar there. Maybe some, there we go. Much better. Whoops. So all of the properties. Properties are just like public variables of a method, right? But they're like kind of smart variables. Methods, events. You can just look this up, right? It's all cross-reference. As I said, we use this. It has smarts built in to do type lookups, member lookups, method lookups, and so on. And a lot of this, as I said, comes from the ECMA documentation. Some of it comes from us. So the system's namespace, system XML or system XML. Oh, here it is, system XML serialization, system XML, blah, blah, blah. Now, the GTK sharp effort is the one that we've been putting most of our effort on. And you can see that there's still a lot of things missing. Everything that says to be added is a class that we haven't documented yet, right? But there's a, lot of documentation already for the other one. I thought this one was on GTK widget. And we're also adding, and although today we use GTK HTML, we're migrating to Mozilla. There's not a lot to show today about Mozilla. The only difference is that Mozilla can do CSS and GTK HTML can't. So we have a couple of ugly hacks in there. We have a couple of ugly hacks in the documentation to render, for example, these things, right? So we use a table, which is nasty. I don't remember where we have samples, but we're supposed to have samples all over the place. Let me see if I can remember where we have some. I think we have some in GC. GC, FG, oh, here we go. Jesus, what is it? Oh, no, set color? No, GC. Oh, and I can't remember where we have. I just wanted to show you a sample. Oh, color mapping? Yeah? Oh, yeah, but I'm running late, and they told me I could run late. Oh, let me just go quickly. Anyway, I'm not going to talk too much about our new VM, just that it's our second generation VM. We support pre-compilation, as I said. Most of there were three motivating factors for rewriting the JIT compiler. One was portability. Before we had a lot of code which was architecture specific. Now we have a very nice split. We basically use a three-level representation. We go from CIL intermediate code to a medium intermediate representation to a low-level intermediate representation. In the last one, we do register allocation plus instruction scheduling on PowerPC. We also have an SSA transformation that can be used both at the MIR level and the LIR level. And what is interesting about that is that most of today's modern optimizations for compilers are built on top of the SSA representation. So we do have some implementations written to, we have some optimizations today written for SSA, but there's a lot more to come. And the problem right now today is balancing between should we finish the PowerPC port or should we have more fun implementing SSA optimizations. And the thing is, there's so many SSA things that you can do that that is fascinating. Pretty much every optimization that was very hard to implement a few years ago turns out to be very simple to do with SSA. I'm not going to talk too much about this, just so you know that there's a very strong emphasis on .NET and in Mono on doing code interoperability, dealing with existing code base. First of all, there's a cross-language interop, so you can have code that it has been provided by multiple language vendors or components that were developed in independent languages. There's facilities for reusing existing C code. You do that through a mechanism called platform invoke. It's a fascinating system, so you can reuse any piece of code that you have in C. That's how we wrapped all of GTK Sharp so quickly, Mozilla, Aug, OpenGL. It's very, very easy to reuse existing C code. And if you need precise management of the binding, there's a mechanism called custom marshalling to do that. we don't have time to show it. And also, just like Python, you can embed the Mono runtime in your application. So you just link your application with Mono. There's a sample in the distribution, and there's also a tutorial for doing that in the monkey guide. Basically, you can add scripting to your application with these things. So you can write scripts in C# or in any other language supported by Mono. One interesting case about interop is that, of course, Java can run on this beast. And just historically, JRuin features developed a JIT that converts from Java bytecodes into CIL bytecodes, right? And he developed this on Windows. This jitter works on Windows, and he got it to the point of running large Java applications. The major success was when he was able to run Eclipse, the IBM IDE, completely in this jitter. So basically, it takes Eclipse, it jits it on the flight, and executes it in the .NET, right? Now, there's a feature in Eclipse that doesn't allow him to pre-compile the code from Java to .NET code because of the way it loaded, but he's working on fixing this. And once we have this, we'll get a big performance improvement, because today we have to rejit Eclipse all the time. And we want to just, instead of jitting Java to .NET and .NET to assembly, we want to do this first step and then use the Mono jitter to do the final step. So we will get a completely native Eclipse binary as soon as we get that bug fixed. Also, every object in Java is exposed to .NET, and every .NET object is exposed to Java, and there's bridges for most of the common data types like string, so that you cannot tell the difference between the two. And I'm going to show you that. I'm going to show you that because I think it's fascinating. It's fascinating for one reason. Apparently today we have the record for the fastest, completely open source, completely self-hosting Java implementation for Linux. So if you want to be completely, open source and you want to run Eclipse, your only option is using Mono. It's the ultimate irony. Right? If you want to use Java completely open source on Linux, you have to use Mono because GCJ, the only way it can run Eclipse, and it takes about a minute to load because we're doing the double jitting, because GCJ requires you to turn off arrays bounds checking, and RVM is not completely self-hosting, so that leaves us and Cafe. And Cafe, I don't think it can even do it. So you either use a proprietary JVM or you use Mono. Isn't that beautiful? You guys are not getting the beauty of the irony here. So it's going to take a while. It's doing its thing. We can take some questions in the meantime as this thing starts up. So as I said, as soon as we fix the problem with the jitting, we'll fix it. I can talk a little about this while this continues jitting. Our jitter works on x86 platforms. That means Linux, XBSD, and Windows. Given that not most, but 50% of the contributors to Mono actually are Windows developers that are looking at migrating their applications to Linux, it was very important for our JIT engine and our whole class libraries to work on Windows. So we do support Windows, even when there's not a lot of point in running Mono and Windows. Oh, and there's Eclipse running in a full open source Java VM using GNU class path. Let me move it to another desktop. And the only problem I have with Eclipse is every time I start it up, I don't know what to do with it. I've never figured out what to do with this thing. So I don't know what to do next. I have no idea what to do. I don't know, guys. I guess I can click here. I don't know. Anyways. So that's Eclipse, right? Running in a full, full open source? Okay, our interpreter works in the PowerPC, as I said, it's gonna be here real soon now. The problem, as I said, is we're torn between getting PowerPC working, which would be awesome for demo purposes, or adding more SSE implementation features that would kick everybody's, that would make everybody look bad. We have an interpreter that works on StrongArm, thanks to Malte, which is here in the audience.
Are you here?
Yeah, there he is. And he has a nice little demo running on an iPad. running GTK Sharp and XML RPC, I think, right? And it works on RPC, Spark, and S390s. What else? What else have we got there? I'm just going to see what it is. And some information on the Mono project there. In the afternoon, I'll do a talk on GTK Sharp. There's a lot of little things. I mean, I think that's the most interesting part of Mono, building GUI applications with it. This is just the foundation on which we're building everything. Fascinating project. I would say it's the most fun project I've ever worked on. But come to the afternoon talk, because that's going to talk about GUI stuff, and we'll show some more interesting things there. Any questions? Wow. Oh, yes. Yeah, well, the reason was that we felt that C Sharp had learned from the mistakes of Java, and it basically contained 5 years of extra user input on top of Java. So, for example, .NET, a focus on .NET was to support multiple languages. In Java, they do support multiple languages, but it's more of a, we hack things into fitting to the JVM. So things like C and C++ do not really work. You cannot really host those in the JVM. As opposed to C Sharp, it's kind of, you can hack it, of course, by allocating a huge array and pretending that's your memory, right? It's kind of an afterthought. Fortran and COBOL also require the same kind of support for C and C++, and this was kind of built into .NET since the beginning. That was one reason. And I think that was a major, and the other one is things like platform invoke. They have platform invoke, they have attributes. As I said, it's just a new version of Java. It's a more modern version of Java. In a way, Sun has started to respond to C Sharp, and you'll see that the latest version of Java, for the first time, they started taking user input seriously. So they got enumerations, they got for each, they finally got generics, right? But it was, I think that C Sharp kind of pushed them into that direction. That's my personal impression. So if it came to implementing that, there was a bunch of Java implementations. Nobody had done really a good job, and I think we did a pretty good job with the .NET thing. A question over there? No? Yes? I know of a company shipping a product, a commercial product called Virtuoso. I don't know how they actually ship it to avoid installation problems. I think they just use their own prefix and they install everything under there, so they have their own copy of Mono. So even if you install a new version, we don't touch their version that they tested and they shipped with. I don't know if that answers your question. Well, if you install everything, including Mozilla, OpenGL, and everything. We took it down to 1.5 megabytes, and we're doing some work for a company. We're doing some contracting work for a company to actually reduce the size of Mono for embedded system use. So for an embedded system, we have a bunch of bigger constraints than that. So we're going to be amputating a lot of things. But my impression is that you're not really concerned about that for your cine film thing, right? That sounds like you have a lot of this space available. Downloads. I think we're up to... I think if you get the whole Mono today, it's something like 10 megabyte download, the binary. But I think that suffice, roughly, for the full beast. Is that, yeah? And it is pretty big. It is pretty big. Well, it includes symbolic information, it includes development tools, it includes ASP.NET. I mean, it includes the whole framework for doing server applications, client applications, embedded applications. It would be ideal to split it up. The DBM people are crazy about splitting things up, so I bet at some point they'll do it. They just can't resist the urge to split everything up. So, and they're split up. I mean, physically, the assemblies are separate. It's just that the Mono team, we as a team, we just publish one RPM with everything inside, and the DBM people like to have the ls command in one package, and the cat command in another package, and the grep command in another package, and put dependencies between them. So I'll guess they'll fix it. Okay, well, thanks for coming.